Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on poison drops in the federal Senate when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. Now, why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA and the EPA or the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, and the IRS, and the many swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, you know there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this thing called private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. Let me tell you more about what it is you're not supposed to know about this thing called private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Or better yet, click on to the archives page and then request or just download that free general law CD package right off of our archives page. All right, we've been talking about a book here written by a guy back in 1886. His name is Zach Montgomery, and he wrote the book kind of in defense of his failure to be confirmed by the Senate as Assistant Attorney General in the Cleveland administration back in 1885. And he wrote quite a blockbuster of a book here, and it has a pretty evocative premise, and that is public school causes crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment. And he said he could prove it back in 1886, and that's what we've been doing. So I showed you from Yoder versus Wisconsin that the Supreme Court of the United States back in 1972 proved exactly what Montgomery had said would be the outcome between 1886 and 1972, because it was the exact same outcome that he observed in the census statistics from 1850 to 1880. So last time I said, let's take a look at what happens when you spend more money on public education. Because the proponents of public education, when you point out Johnny can't read and he can't do math, and his academic level is deteriorating, and there's nothing but crime and violence in these public schools, they come back and say, well, see, that's caused because we've got poverty, because we don't have enough money. And so Montgomery, clear back in the 1880s, says, no, that's not the case. In fact, the more money you spend on public education, the worse the problem becomes. Now remember, there's six areas of problem here. We ostensibly send our children to public school. We send them, we educate them, we want them to be able to read and write so that they won't become criminals, they won't become paupers. They won't become insane. We don't want them to commit suicide. We don't want them to be violent, and we don't want them to be unemployed. We want people to be fully employed, peaceful. We don't want suicide. We don't want insanity. We don't want poverty, and we don't want criminality. And they tell us that if we educate our children in public school, we'll have all of these utopian social solutions to our problems, and everything's going to be just roasty toasty. So he starts off in chapter 3, and he says this: in their desperate efforts to find some plausible explanation for the astounding growth of crime in the public school states, in excess of that found in the parental school districts, which will vindicate their idolized system, the advocates of state-governed schools have sometimes claimed that the difference between the number of convictions for crime in the public school states and the difference in the number of crimes found in the parental school states is owing to a variety of local causes, entirely unconnected with the independence of difference in educational systems. But a complete refutation of this assumption is found in the following statistics of the public school education and crime, demonstrating that in the very same localities, every material increase of expenditures for public school purposes has, without a single exception, been followed by a corresponding increase of crime. For example, he starts off with Massachusetts. Now let's get this firmly in our mind. Montgomery says this: if you increase the expenditures per student in the public school system, you will get more crime, more poverty, more insanity, more suicides, more violence, and more unemployment without exception. There's never an exception to this rule. Period. There was no exception in 1972. There is none today when we measure society and public school against the Amish. And there wasn't from 1850 to 1880. It always works out exactly the same. Now, here's what it is. In 1850, the state of Massachusetts had a native white population of about 800,000 people. At that date, her public school pupils numbered about 175,000, and her income for the support of these schools was $1 million, which averaged out to about $6 for each student. So they spent about $6 each. $5.70 is the exact number, but about $6. Now, with this comparatively limited expenditure for the maintenance of her anti-parental schools, she had, out of a native population of 800,000, 653 native-born criminals. So you got 800,000 people, and they get about 650 criminals locked up. That was one to every 1,200 native inhabitants. Now, this, comparatively speaking, was a very small number for a public school state, though a very large number when compared with the number of criminals in any of the parental or private school states. Now, coming down to 1880, 30 years later, we find that the income for public school purposes had swollen to $4.5 million for the benefit of 300,000 public school students, and they increased their expenditures per pupil to about $15, counting every pupil that attended school at any time during the year. Now, Massachusetts expended on her schools during that same time more than her income, to wit, the sum of $4.7 million, being $20 for the pupils in average daily attendance. And out of a native-born white population of 1.3 million, there were 2,070 adult native white convicts, being 1 to every 650 inhabitants, in place of 1 to every 1,260, as it was in 1850. Now, this leaves out of the account some 608 juvenile convicts confined in various reformatory institutions that weren't counted in 1850. But including those, the native white convicts of Massachusetts in 1880 would amount to 1 out of every 493 native white inhabitants. Okay, now here's what happened. Remember, they were spending $6 in 1850. They increased that to $15, three times as much, by 1880. And the number of criminals increased by 3 times if you count the number of juvenile delinquents. If you leave them out, it was 2 to 1. So just counting the adults, in 30 years, they expended 3 times as much money and increased crime by double. And every single state follows that exact pattern. Followed it back then, it follows that exact pattern to this moment in time. Now, you may be sitting there saying, well, but I don't understand why. Well, I'm going to show you why when we get to the end of our series here. I'm going to show you in spades why public school does that. But even if we didn't know why, we know that it does. I mean, that's like driving a car and you have an accident and you say, well, I don't know why I had that accident. You don't need to. You got a wrecked car over there. You can see that there was an accident. Now, it would be good if we could figure out the cause, because then maybe we could fix that cause. Now, the cause for this crime and this unemployment and so on, it's a cause and effect relationship. There's no doubt about that. And the creator of the universe, this is God Almighty himself, when he was giving this instruction, this educational instruction, the education law to Moses at Mount Sinai, with specificity, he made 2 requirements. Number one, you educate everybody to the standards of this scripture, to the standards of law that I'm giving you here in this law. He wanted everybody to have a legal education. That's number one. Number two, it's the duty of the parental head, the patriarch of the family, to educate his children. It is not to be farmed out to the state. It's not to be farmed out to tutors or somebody else. It's against the law for you people to send your children over here to a Catholic school, a Protestant school, or some other institution. The duty is with the patriarch of the family. You got 5 kids there, Buster, and all 5 of them are to be educated by you. Got that? Now, you're sitting there saying, I can't do that. Well, you could if you put your mind to it, but you've decided you don't want to do that. And that's perfectly natural. I mean, I want to have sex. I just don't want to have to feed, clothe, and house the results of it. But, you know, that's where life's at. You know, with the fun also comes responsibility. And that's what our problem is. The government comes in here and says, we'll take that responsibility from you. Hey, we'll educate these children. As if the government over here is giving you something. Listen, boys and girls, the $10,700 that you're spending on this education, it isn't being paid for by anybody in Washington, D.C. It's being paid for by you. And in order to expend $10,700 on education, they've got to collect about $15,000 so that they can spend $10,700 over here. They got to administer that. In fact, it's probably more like they're collecting 20. Now, this Barack Obama the other day, our president, here in the United States, we got a new president over here. His name is Barack Obama. And he's just enacted socialized medicine here in the United States, which they've been trying to do for over 100 years. I mean, they've been trying to get America to embrace this socialized medicine, and Americans have rejected socialized medicine now for 100 years. So this year he got the job done, and he gets all the credit for it. And that one of the benefits that we're supposed to get is that this is not going to raise your taxes by a dime. You know, it's going to raise the taxes of the rich. It's going to raise the taxes of corporations and businesses, but it's not going to raise your taxes, Joe Sixpack, the guy that's going to receive all these benefits. So they told us we had about 45 million people who are uninsured. And there's a lot of poor people in there that can't afford this health care insurance. So the Obama administration, they went out to the 4 parties that are involved in this. And they went to the insurance companies, the doctors through the American Medical Association, the hospitals through their association, and the pharmaceutical industry. And they said to the pharmaceutical industry, we need your support to pass the socialized medicine bill, which is called National Health Care Insurance. See, here in America, if you said we want socialized medicine, like you people in England and Canada and so on, we would reject that. We hate socialism over here. We have a thingy about socialism. We don't want. So the bill now, when it came out, was 2,700 pages. 2,700 pages, of which none of the legislators ever read. Can you imagine reading 2,700 pages in a particular bill, which isn't even complete until the day when they're going to vote on it? So the pharmaceutical industry, they sat down and they said, okay, well, here's what we want, and they wrote up a 500 or 600 pages. Then the hospitals, they went to their lobbying groups and they said, well, what is it that we want? And they wrote up their little section of the 400 or 500 pages. And then they went to the doctors and said, okay, now what do you guys want? And so the doctors wrote up 400 or 500 pages, and here's what we want. And then they went to the hospitals and, you know, so on. And so 2,700 pages later, they've got a thingy that says, okay, here's what everybody wants. Now, here's what the insurance industry wanted. They wanted compulsory insurance for everybody. Everybody has to participate, just like automobiles. In this country, we have a program in all the states where everybody has to buy auto insurance. There's actually two other alternatives that you have, but leaving that out, that's what they tell you, see. And so everybody buys insurance. Well, these four institutions then went to work through their lobbying groups, and they wrote up the bill. And there's four things that that all Americans believe they have to have. They believe they have to have banking, insurance, public education, highway traffic enforcement, and fire departments. Can't live without it. Now, when we take a look at banking over here, the banks over here just got bailed out, remember? They're the ones that caused the economic collapse around the world. And then the taxpayers have to come in and bail them out to the tune of $29 trillion. And I got to ask the question, and you need banks? What in the hell do you need banks for? Well, to run the world's economy into bankruptcy, and then we can bail them out. I guess that's why we need banks. Second over here, we've got to have public education, and we believe we have to have public education because it's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, and we all went to public school, didn't we? And then we have to have highway traffic enforcement, don't we? We've got to have Ranger Rick out there on the highway giving us tickets when we don't buckle our seat belts. And then we've got to have fire departments. We've got to have fire departments to put out fires, and we always have this picture. I remember there's a picture that I saw in my... I forget now what office it was, some insurance office someplace. And anyways, it's a really neat-looking picture. This house is on fire. The flames are licking into the sky above of the second or third story. Inside the window of the second story is a little girl. Flames about to consume her. But there's a fire engine out front with a ladder on it, a hook and ladder. And a fireman races up the ladder to the second floor and snatches the little girl out of the jaws of death and carries her down the ladder to safety. And then there's a caption down here at the bottom over here, you know, thank God for firemen and first responders and all these guys. And that's really good, and it's nice to see. And the picture that we have in our minds when we talk about fire insurance and we talk about fire departments and funding these first responders, is that there's the picture in our minds of the fireman on the ladder snatching the little girl from the jaws of death. Now, in reality, that never happens. By the time the fire department gets to the house, all of the victims are already dead from smoke inhalation before the fire department ever got there. That's where reality's at. That's what we actually see on the 6 o'clock news. Now, there's a reason why we have that picture, though, in our minds, and why the insurance industry is constantly bombarding us with this propaganda. See, our worldview is skewered by the propaganda that we see from the insurance industry, the banking industry, and the education industry. These three institutions continually bombard us with propaganda. You see, if you don't support your public schools, your children are going to grow up ignorant, and you're going to be enmeshed in crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment. And we all believe it. We've been told that all my life. You know, I'm an old man, and I've been told that all my life. That's the mindset that I have. My God, if they closed the public school in Gainesville, we would be inundated with crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment. Now, the fact that we are already inundated by crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment, that's the status quo. That's where we're already at. So we cannot think beyond the bun. See, we can't get outside the box because we've already been propagandized. Now let's take a look at this thing of fire departments. I lived in Boise, Idaho, and I did a little research project on this thing of fire departments. And the first question came to my mind. When was the last time that a house actually burned to the ground in the city limits of Boise, Idaho? And the answer was 1957. Burned to the ground. And I took a look at the number of fire departments, and I took a look at my location on Roosevelt Street, and I had four fire departments within four blocks of me. Now, I'm the only guy in town who had that, but I lived up on the first bench, and there was one on Americana, one on Fairview, one on Orchard. There was three, and there was one more somewhere. I'll think of it here in a minute. Fairview, Orchard, and Americana. Three, anyway. I think there's a fourth one. It made me often wonder, when I called the fire department telling my house is burning down, which fire department was going to respond, or would all three of them come? Now, the bank said, well, you got a mortgage on your house here, little Georgie, so you got to have fire insurance. So I went down and I bought my fire insurance. Now, here's what fire insurance is. I pay $500 a year to the fire insurance company. Now, my house is worth $100,000, and I pay them $500 for a premium. And I say, my house is going to burn down this year, and the fire insurance company is saying, no, it won't. Your house is not going to burn down this year. And I put my $500 in there, and they say, we'll give you 200-to-1 odds. If your house burns to the ground, we'll pay you $100,000. So I paid them the $500, and I waited patiently for 365 days, and the damn house didn't burn down. And I said, well, shouldn't you give me back my premium? My house didn't burn down. They said, no, that's the bet. We call it a premium. They don't call it bets in insurance. They call them premiums. You bet $500, and you said your house is going to burn down. And we said, no, we'll give you 200-to-1 odds. If your house burns down, we'll give you $100,000. And it didn't burn. We win. We were right. So I said, well, I got to have another piece of the action. Here's another $500. By God, it'll burn down this year. So I put my $500 in the pot, and I waited patiently for another 365 days, and the damn house didn't burn down again. 2 years in a row. I'm out $1,000, and the damn house didn't burn down. Well, I did this research, and I found out that in Boise, Idaho, they have, on average, one fire a week. They call them kitchen fires. Typically, your fire is going to be in the kitchen, a grease fire, and it'll cause $14,000 damage. Now, here's another little kicker. After you've studied these statistics, you say to yourself, well, if the last time a house burned to the ground was 1957, and the average house fire is $14,000, instead of insuring my house for $100,000, betting that it's going to burn to the ground, I should just insure it for $14,000, that we're going to have a grease fire in the kitchen. Now, here's what happens. Let's suppose that you reduce your insurance from $100,000 to, oh, let's say, $20,000. You know, in case you have a little bit better kitchen fire than the average. And instead of paying $500, you only pay $100. You got one-fifth the coverage. because that's statistically what's going to happen. So you just have $20,000 worth of insurance, pay $100, and sure enough, this year you win. You have a kitchen fire, and it burns $20,000, and you go to the insurance company and you say, hey, I got a $20,000 claim, $20,000 fire, paid my insurance premium, and the insurance company says, oh, we're not going to pay you $100,000 because you didn't have $100,000 worth of damage, and you didn't have $100,000 worth of coverage. Well, that's reasonable. I mean, we only took one-fifth the bet, so we're only entitled to one-fifth the coverage. All right, well, then write me a check for $20,000. The insurance company says, oh, no, we're not going to write you a check for $20,000. We're going to write you a check for 20% of $20,000, $4,000. So we're going to pay you. You didn't carry full coverage on the house. To get full coverage on the damage, you have to carry full coverage on the house. So you have to have insurance for $100,000 so that you can get the full $20,000 worth of insurance on the $20,000 loss. Since you only insured your house for one-fifth of its full market value, we'll only pay you 20% of the damage, which is $4,000. How do you like that for a neat deal, huh? Now, you talk about criminality. All of these people that work for the insurance companies, the lawyers that write up these contracts, they all went to public school. And if that's not criminal, you tell me what is, huh? Now, did the insurance agent explain that to you when he came in there? Hey, you people down on the Gulf Coast, now, did they explain to you when you bought that tornado insurance before Hurricane Katrina that most of the damage is caused by water damage and that you needed a rider on your premium to cover the water damage because when the tornado or the hurricane comes, if it doesn't blow your house down, we ain't paying? Well, you found out after the hurricane, but did anybody tell you that before the hurricane? Isn't that criminal? And didn't all of those insurance agents and all of those insurance adjusters and all those insurance executives, didn't they all go to public school, huh? And wasn't that criminal? Hell, those criminals are right out there in the front of you, aren't they? All right. Now, that proves my point. So I just wanted to show you here that fire departments are something that we can live without. The truth of the matter is, most of you people have fire insurance on your house. And every time you pay your premium, you're betting your house burns to the ground. What you really want is when the fire gets started that nobody comes and the house burns to the ground so that you can collect 100 cents on the dollar. I mean, after all, that's why you buy fire insurance. And if that's not why you're buying fire insurance, you should start asking yourself, well, what in the hell am I doing this for? You know, when you put $20 on the pass line on a crap table for crying out loud, you're betting that the dice are coming up 7 or 11 on the first throw. Have you ever seen anybody on a crap table put $20 on the pass line and say, come on, craps. Come on, craps. I want to throw a 2. And you throw the dice and the 2 comes up. You jump up and down. Yay, yay. I got craps on the first throw. As the croupier hauls your $20 away. Huh? You ever seen that? What in the hell are you betting? You're betting with the insurance company over here that your house is going to burn to the ground. And then you go pay $500 a year property tax so that your city government can put another fire department 4 blocks away so that if your house catches on fire, they can rush over there and put the fire out so that you can't collect. You ever seen anybody go up on the crap table, put $20 on the pass line, and then say, hey, I got loaded dice here. They only throw 2s. Huh? Give me those loaded dice that only throw craps. I don't know, guys. We go to public school, and we claim to be educated, and we get degrees after our names, but then we're not able to think. Now, there's another one over here, this public education program over here. They tell us that we got to have these banks. And so we do business with the banks, don't we? And then the banks over here charge us 28% interest. Isn't that usury? You know, when I was a kid, if you charged over 6%, that was usury. We used to have laws in this country against usury, and if we caught somebody practicing usury, we called them a criminal and we threw them in prison. The banks today charge over 6%. They charge up to 30%. And nobody's throwing these guys in prison. In fact, they don't even call them criminals anymore. That's banking. Then they raise your rates without any notice. Then if you miss a payment over here on your Bank of America card, then your MasterCard over here, they say, well, we're gonna double your insurance or double your interest payments over here because you missed a payment over here with this other company. They gouge you with all kinds of fees. They send you your bill at different times of the month so that you'll miss the payment date so that they can add a $5 late fee. They use every kind of trick and chicanery that you can imagine. And these people all have been to public school, and they all work for the bank, and they're all cheating you. They're all criminals, and you accept it, and you keep going back for more. You may get mad as hell and change from Bank of America and go to Wells Fargo, but you don't quit banking because of the criminal activity. You keep on doing the criminal activity with the banks. You just do it with different criminals. Well, okay, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right. Now that we're through with the halfway reminders here, this book is written by Zach Montgomery, and a first published in 1886 by Gibson Brothers. It was reprinted by Thomas Press, Houston, Texas, in Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas 77235. Once more, that's Thomas Press, P.O. Box 35096, Houston, Texas 77235. Now, if you can't get a copy of it there, nor from a local used bookstore, I can't find you one, then go to bravenewbookstore.com. I'll bet you that they can get it for you. That's bravenewbookstore.com, or call them direct at 512 512-480-2503. Again, that's 512-480-2503. You ever go out on the highway there and you get a highway cop after you, see? And the highway cop, now he wants to give you a ticket because you didn't buckle your seatbelt or something like that. And so they tell us, well, see, the highway cop, he's just out there to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And that's a lie. That's not true. The highway patrolman's not out there to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And then we didn't have highway cops out here on the Oregon Trail when our forefathers left St. Louis and they went out across the prairies. They didn't have any highway patrolmen giving them tickets because they didn't buckle their seat belts and they were going too fast up and down the trail, beating their horses or driving them furiously or something like that. But that's something that developed. It developed along with insurance. And here's what the reason is. It's the insurance industry that goes into the legislature to lobby for seat belt laws, compulsory insurance, and all of these traffic safety laws and rules and regulations and so on. And that's to protect the claims window of the insurance company. I mean, think about us, be intelligent and rational people. Do you really care if I buckle my seatbelt? I'm driving down the road and I don't have my seatbelt on. And you're sitting there saying, you know, you dummy, why you could roll your car over and you could get thrown out and you'd get run over by your own car as it's rolling over down the hill and you'd get killed because you don't have your seatbelt on. And so my question to you is, so what? How does that bother you? How does that affect you? And you say, well, I just love you, Mr. Gordon, and I want to send an agent of mine out there to give you a $300 ticket and put you in jail for 6 months because you're dumb and you didn't buckle your seatbelt. Well, thanks, Tom. I just needed somebody like you. With friends like you, who in the hell needs enemies? But let me tell you what the real reason is. The real reason is that the insurance company has all these people insured. And if I get thrown out of my car and I get killed, it costs the insurance company more than if I stay in the car and I just get crippled up. So the insurance agency, the insurance company, the industry, they go to the legislature and say, we need a seatbelt law. That's to compel the manufacturers to put seatbelts in the car because we're the people that have an insurable interest. And if Gordon gets injured over there, if we can keep him in the car and hold his injuries down, it holds down our liabilities. And so to enforce that law, they got to have agents. And they don't want to pay the agents. And they want the taxpayers to pay the agents. So the insurance industry, I mean, these are smart people. They go to public school, and they'll learn how to be real criminals. And so they've got you, the taxpayer, buying a car with seatbelts in it, and you have to pay for that because the auto industry has to put the seatbelts in as a matter of law, and so they charge it and they put those in. So they got you buying and paying for your seatbelts. Now, if you don't use your seatbelt over here, the insurance company goes to the legislature and they say, well, we want compulsory insurance. Make Gordon buy insurance or punish him by putting him in jail. So now I got to buy insurance. Now the insurance company is liable for my injuries. So now they say, well, now we got to have an agent out there, along with the seatbelt law, and we'll call him a highway patrolman, to enforce that law to protect our financial interest at the claims window. So all of these regulatory laws that we're dealing with here that impose limits to your freedoms and decisions and choices is instigated by the insurance industry, which you've been taught from early childhood, you can't live without insurance. I mean, you just had a student in here one time, and we were talking about insurance over here, and he just got mad as hell, and he just read me the Riot Act and tore me a new one, preaching a sermon about insurance and about how wonderful it was and how his wife got killed in a car that was hit by a Mexican who didn't have insurance. And I said, well, if that Mexican had insurance, would your wife have survived the crash? That even made him madder. Boys and girls, having insurance doesn't prevent accidents. It simply says that somebody's going to pay this damage over here based upon some contractual liability. That's why God, in Exodus 22:28, I believe it is, or 23:28, gives us a negligent statute over here that requires strict liability. The opposite to insurance is strict liability. The biblical model is strict liability. Now, nobody wants to be liable, so we want limited liability. All of us just naturally desire to cause damage to somebody else and have somebody else pay for it. I don't want to pay for it. Yeah, I want to get the girl knocked up, but I don't want to pay for it. Well, okay, but, you know, sex requires responsibilities, and sometimes, you know, the girls get knocked up, and then you got this bread snapper to feed for the next 20 years. Well, we don't think about that, do we? And we don't think about that when we're dealing with the highway patrol, banking, insurance, and public education, and highway traffic enforcement, and fire departments. But, you know, we got to pay for all of that. And we do. And we are. We don't pay for it in taxes. We pay for it in insurance premiums. Or we pay for it with banking fees and so on. We don't need banks. We don't need insurance companies. We don't need public education. We don't need highway traffic enforcement. And we don't need fire departments. It's the banking and insurance industries that need public education, highway traffic enforcements, and fire departments. And they need customers, and so they need public education to teach us that we can't live without insurance and banking. Now, once they've got us convinced that we can't live without insurance and banking, well, then we've got to have public education, highway traffic enforcement, and fire departments, Noah. I mean, that's the way that game is played. Now, clear back here in the 1880s, the root cause of this problem over here being public education, which doesn't have anything to do with anybody's education, as Charlotte Isherby points out in her book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. Americans are dumb as a box of rocks, but by God, they know how to write checks, do banking, and pay their insurance premiums and send their kids to public school. That's what we're taught and trained to do. That's our job. That's what public education is all about, is to teach you how to bank and pay your insurance premiums. And then make sure that you obey the highway traffic enforcement and fire departments. And then fund them. And we do. And, you know, the system works like a shot. Let's take a look at another one over here. Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Rhode Island, Connecticut. Each one of these public education states between 1850 and 1880 spent more money on their public schools each and every year. They kept raising the amount of money. So, as an illustration here in Vermont, Vermont had an income for school purposes of $246,000 for the education of 100,000 pupils. They were spending about $2.50 per pupil in 1850. At the same time, they had a native population of about 280,000, of whom only 64, or 1 to every 4,300, were criminals. But turning to the census report for 1880, we find that Vermont expended $452,000 on 73,000 students, and they raised it from $2.50 to $6.50 per pupil. Or counting only the 47,000 pupils in average daily attendance, we got $9.58 per pupil. And instead of one criminal for every 4,000 inhabitants, as they had in 1850, by 1880, they had, out of a native population of 290,000, 196 convicts, being one to every 1,481 native whites. So when to these are added the 134 native white juvenile offenders, of whom she seems to have had none in 1850, we have an aggregate of 330, or one native white criminal for every 880 native whites. Crime increased five times, from 879 to 4,372. I mean, I didn't write that. I'm just telling you that's what happened. They tripled the amount of money that they spent on education, and they got a better return. They got five times more criminals per capita. It doesn't get any better than that. Unless you go to New Hampshire. There's one up eight times. Yeah. So in Maine, it went up six times. Rhode Island, it only went up three times. The people in Rhode Island were really the failures. They increased their public expenditures from $5.50 to $12.75, and they only got They only doubled the number of criminals. Isn't that just special? Doubled. Listen to it. Here's the winner over here. This is New Hampshire. New Hampshire in 1850 expended on her schools, public and private, about $220,000. They were educating 81,000 students. They were spending about $2.75 per kid in 1850. Out of a native population of 303,000, they had just 25 criminals, being one to every 12,000 population. 30 years later, with an income of $560,000 for the use of 64,000 students, $8.64 for every student attending school, $11.42 per pupil, and had 48,900 in average daily attendance, and presto changeo, instead of one native criminal out of every 12,000 that they had in 1850, when they were expending about one-fourth as much money for each pupil. Now, out of 300,000 natives, 209 criminals, or one to every 1,400 native white inhabitants. Then we add to that their juvenile criminals for 1880-91. So we have an aggregate criminal population of 300, or one to every 1,000 of our native white population. So that's eight times more criminals in 30 years in that state by spending more money. By spending more money. And every time that the government has to answer to us, and why is it that our public schools are performing so poorly? Why is it that Johnny can't read? Why is it that every other nation in the industrialized world scores higher than we do? They say, well, it's poverty. We need to spend more money on our public schools. You know, if we just spend more money, which is where we just were. See, the bank says you have to have fire insurance on your house. What do they care? Because they're carrying the mortgage on your house. You see, those of us that own our homes free and clear, we don't have to have insurance. It's the bank that requires that you have insurance. Are they concerned about your little blonde, blue-eyed daughter on the second floor with flames licking around her about to consume her? No, they're concerned about getting paid the mortgage in case your house burns. So they say to you, as a condition of loaning you the money to buy the house, you have to buy fire insurance. And so you agree. Then if you don't have insurance on your house, you're in default, and so now the bank can foreclose on you and take your house because you didn't buy insurance. Or they'll just buy the insurance and tack it on to your mortgage payment, or some combination thereof. No, the bank, they're concerned about themselves. They're not concerned about you at all. In order to sell this, though, We have to have a public relations campaign. And so the 6 o'clock news, you know, your local news, they work hand in glove with City Hall. Have you ever noticed that your news outlet, you know, your TV news, where do they get the stories that they present to you every night on the 6 o'clock news? They get it from the police department, the fire department, and the mayor's office and the city council. Those are the four places that they go to find the news. So when they start off on the news, they'll start off with a fire, somebody's house burned, or they'll start off with a traffic accident someplace, or they've got some burglaries and some criminal activity that's going on in the community, and so they report from the police department. Then they give you the political news. We're going to raise your sales tax. or this, that, or something else. And that blends itself right into the local school news. They'll have a blurb in there, you know, about how we need more money for our public schools, or how the city council is going to vote on this, that, or something else for this school or that school district over there, or the new school superintendent's name is. Nobody is reporting about what's going on here in the local community, in the business community. They're reporting to you politics and fire department, police department. They're reporting the public news, which supports the public schools and the public political process. Fire department, police department. Are your policemen going to get their increase, you know, in their pay? They're going to get their increase in their pension fund. And the 6 o'clock news is in reality a propaganda. It's an infomercial is what it is. An infomercial. They're selling you something every time. In 1850, the state of New York had a native population of 2.5 million. She then had in her schools, all told, about 727,000 pupils at an annual cost of $2.5 million. That was about $3.35 per student. That's in 1850. At that time, our native-born criminals numbered 650, or one out of every 3,700 native inhabitants. But with the laudable purpose of lessening the tendency of her people to commit crime, the state government went year by year increasing the burden of taxation for public school purposes, until in 1880 the receipts for education was for a million children were $11 million, or about $11 for every student that entered her schools at any time during the year. And the result was that with a native white population of 3.8 million, they had 5,000 native white criminals in prison, being one to every 750 people, instead of one to every 3,700 people as they had in 1850. That is to say, having increased her expenditures for this anti-parental and godless schools a little more than 300% in order to decrease crime, she was rewarded by an increasing crime to the same tune of 500%. So they spent three times as much money and got five times the number of criminals. Isn't that special? Now remember, Montgomery said, in every single case without exception, that's every state in the Union experiences this very same phenomenon. I don't care whether you live in Wisconsin or California or New York or Florida or wherever it's at. And not only was it true between 1850 and 1880, it was true between 1880 and 1910 and 1910 and 1940. And then it is true between 1972 with Yoder versus Wisconsin and 2002 and today, and it will continue to be true into the future. The more money you spend on public schools, the more crime you're going to get. You're going to get more crime, more poverty, more insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment. And it'll go up exponentially. If you spend twice as much money, you'll get three times as much crime, four times or five times as much crime. You actually get more bang for your buck. In fact, what's happening here is you're actually receiving what you're paying for. Let me show you how this crime thing works. The chief of police of Boise, Idaho, went into the city council and he said, crime last year went up 5%. Therefore, I'm requesting an increase of 5% more policemen, 5% more equipment, that is patrol cars, and 5% more money. And so the city council said, well, my God, if crime went up 5% last year, then to combat crime, then it makes all the sense in the world to appropriate 5% more money for the police department and 5% more money for patrol cars and 5% more for more policemen. And so the chief of police got it. So 365 days goes by, and the next year the chief of police comes back to city government and he says, my God, crime went up by 5% last year. So therefore we need 5% more policemen, 5% more money, 5% more patrol cars, 5% more laws, And the city council said, well, my God, if crime goes up by 5% every year, then we got to increase the budget to combat crime by 5%. We got to have 5% more policemen. We got to have 5% more patrol cars. And we've got to have 5% more new city ordinances over here to combat all this crime wave that's going on. Another 365 days goes by, and by God, you just almost can bet on it, crime goes up by 5%. And the chief comes back and he says, oh my God, crime went up by 5% last year, so therefore I got to have 5% more money, 5% more police. You getting the drift here? See where we're going? Well, now listen. If you give the chief of police 5% more money and 5 more policemen, you know, he has 100 policemen and crime goes up by 5%, so now he's got 105 policemen. Doesn't he have 5 more policemen out there looking for 5% more violations? If the city council enacts 5% more laws, then don't we have 5% more laws, rules, and regulations to enforce? Therefore, won't we have 5% more violations? And won't that translate into 5% more crime? Boys and girls, when you increase your expenditures for the police department by 5%, you're buying 5% more crime. When you put on 5% more policemen, those 5% more policemen are going to be out there arresting 5% more people. And so, therefore, you're going to have an increase of 5% of crime. And then the local news media, they jump right in, oh my God, we're in the midst of a crime wave. Why, crime has gone up by 5%. And the mayor and the city council are meeting an emergency session with the chief of police. And the police commissioner is trying to figure out what we're going to do with this crime. And I came up with a solution. We'll raise your taxes by 5%. We'll give you 5 more policemen, 5% more laws, 5% more patrol cars. And we'll go out and find 5% more criminals, so crime will grow by 5%. If you want a crime rate to grow by 10%, then give them 10% more money, 10 more patrol cars, and 10% more policemen, and you can raise crime by 10%. We can demonstrate that right here. If you want to increase crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment, then you give the public school more money. Hell, it's been working that way for 150 years, and it has never failed, not a single time. No exceptions to the rule. And the same thing here is true here with crime. So if you don't appropriate more money to combat crime, then you won't have an increase in the criminal statistics. Isn't that just special? All right, now this book is called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It's put out by a guy named Zach Montgomery, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, The School Question. If you can't find it in your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, go to bravenewbookstore.com. Bravenewbookstore.com. You can call them. They're in Austin, Texas. The number is 512-480-2503. Again, that's area code 512-480-2503. BraveNewBookstore.com, or you can write to Thomas Press, P.O. Box 35096, Houston, Texas, and the zip code is 77235. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder that you have been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's George.